Hi there, welcome to the Castorbis Podcast with a K, and this is a very special podcast recorded at the VWOPCon event in September 2018. What you're about to hear is a conversation between myself and James McLean, my usual co-host, and I dare say legendary Doctor Who and television director Graham Harper.
Welcome to this new podcast with the K, with me, Christian Crawley, and James McLean. We're joined, somewhat humbled to say, by Graham Harper, well-known Doctor Who director. We've been kind of debating whether or not we're going to be talking about classic or modern Who or where to start. I want to start, actually, because we're in Manchester, and you did a key episode of Coronation Street a few years ago. With a tram crash.
I did.
Which was amazing. Because it was Coronation Street, and you know, looking back at Coronation Street, there's been things like that have happened before, haven't they? But there was obviously like modern production standards brought into it. Was that the only episode that you did though?
I've done about 45 episodes of Coronation Street in my life.
Right.
When I was doing Doctor Who, the modern series with Phil Collinson. Phil eventually left Doctor Who after a few years, 5 years, I think it was, that's it. And he moved on to Coronation Street and became their showrunner.
Yeah.
And when they wanted to do the 50th anniversary, for some reason, which was really nice for me, he thought of me to do, they wanted to do a tram crash. Wipe out half the site and whatever in story, and he thought of me, which was absolutely brilliant for me, very flattering. Or maybe I was the only one available. I don't know, Martin. But because I'd done Doctor Who and had that experience with the mill and with special effects, doing all the effects we did on the Who stories that I worked on, and obviously they worked on all the others. He felt it was natural that one of us, one of those directors, should be one of his the directors to do that, and it was me. If I hadn't had that experience, we would have done this too if I'd been offered the job, but I think it was easy for me to be able to talk the shorthand you needed with the guys from the mill and the guys from special effects to create that whole epic thing and make it look really good. And I hope we did. I mean, I really hope that people were convinced by it, but there were certain elements of the shooting that we were allowed to do, we could make happen with the money they provided to make it really convincing, like a real cab, a section of the cab with the driver in it coming to the last, like the last 10 feet to a halt, as it were. Those real moments made all the CGI stuff really work, I think.
I think it's comparable to 2 years later, the similar incident in Ripper Street. Have you seen that?
No, I've seen Ripper Street. I don't remember anything.
When it moved to Amazon, it got a bigger budget, and there's a train crash in the
first episode of the third season,
which Jerome Flynn's character is on. He's been in Manchester, funny enough, and he's gone back to London, back to H Division. And there's a crash in that, and I think the two are comparable. I think yours clearly stands up. This one's actually newer, and it's on a far greater budget. But I don't think there's an awful lot between them.
I don't watch Coronation Street, not since I was like 10. Has there only been one tram crash? Is that the one that comes off the bridge?
It comes off the bridge. But I think there was one before we were introduced to the world, I think.
I know the one, then. That's good. Did you feel, with Coronation Street, you've got a show with as much mythic baggage as Doctor Who. Was there any sort of trepidation in doing such a landmark thing? Or are you just now so much, you just go in and you know how to get that job done as they expect?
Every job I do, especially with big events, I'm really nervous or really anxious that we get it right, that I'm good enough to be able to cope with it. But of course, with all those, all the shows that you do, in the end, you collaborate with your team. The team are allowed to have some say in it. And you pick and choose what you fancy are the best moments from the crew, you know, from the DOP and the camera, the operators. it's a collaboration of how you're going to achieve what you want to get. They want to hear from you as a director what you envisage, what your vision is, and they will then, if you allow them, they will then offer fabulous ways and maybe lots of fabulous ways to do things that you can choose. So that's, we get that out of the way. It's not just you on your own. But the first day of shoot on anything I do, whatever it's got involved, I'm really nervous. But within the first hour, you're off. And once the ball's rolling or the juggernaut's running, you can't stop it and you ride it. You actually then forget all the nerves and get on with, oh yeah, that's going to work. And then suddenly it all starts, if you're lucky, falling into place and it works. So the difficulty with Coronation Street when I first started was I didn't know the artists. Of course, I knew them from seeing the show, but I didn't know any of them. And they didn't know me, so there's a lot of boxing and coxing and them checking out, oh, is he the kind of director we can work with, or does he want some silly thing? There were some difficult odd moments that got sorted very quickly with other actors marking my card as to whether I should direct them or not or whatever, but in the end it all got sorted out quite quickly, and it all falls into place, and you find a way of working with everybody that hopefully works. So I've digressed, but I'm always nervous. I don't go in thinking, oh yeah, this is a piece of cake. They never are, and if you go in with that attitude, it will come and hit you right in the face when that, it'll kick out the backside when you're not looking. So no, nerves is a good thing.
Is there a frustration? I mean, a bit like film, less with television, but if anything, if a story or a show doesn't go well, you either get, so three people blamed. It's either the actor, the writer maybe, but often the director as well. Do you feel, does that weigh on you? Or do you think that's fair? Because, you know, as you say, you are in some degrees there to sort of move the pieces as you need them to be moved. But you get the responsibility in the end.
It's done to you. A good example, I did a serial called Custer's Last Stand-Up, which was about a young boy of 14 in Northern Ireland who just wanted, his whole life was wanted to be a stand-up comic. And he has a buck-tooth kind of friend who, with those lovely Northern Irish accents, especially from Belfast, who became his manager. So there were two 14-year-olds. One was the manager trying to get his protege a gig or two. The Northern Irish producer I had was quite a... He was a wonderful character, but he was full of comedy and he was a teaser. But the first day of shoot, he said to me on this first scene we were rehearsing, he said, I finished rehearsal, he said, before we're going to shoot, he said, so you're happy with that, are you? And I said, how do you mean? He said, well, I'm not happy. And I said, oh, okay, what's wrong? He said, oh, well, more guts and bollocks than that. That's no scene. And he was really upset that I hadn't got the anger that was required for this scene from one of the actors, the young kids. And I said, oh, okay, yeah, I don't see it quite that way. He said, well, I bloody do. I want some guts and bollocks. So I went in, okay, there's another way of doing it. Let's go in. So I went back in, asked the crew, just give me another 5 minutes. We replayed that to ourselves, the young guys, and I said to them what the producer said and what he wanted, and I covered it by saying, do you know what, I agree with him, let's have a go, let's really show the crew again with this new aggression. They were fighting, but I saw it as a mock fight. So that's the first scene of a show that has never been seen before that we're all nervous about, and I felt really, oh god, I'm going to have a real problem with this producer. We did the scene, he said to me, no, that's a scene, he said, and that, from now on, Graham, I know that you know what I'm dreaming of. And he was right, because that was a scene in the middle of the episode. I knew how to go back to the beginning and build up to that. And we made a fantastic episode, which won an award in the end. And I really was worried about, I was going to be sacked any minute now for the first month. I wasn't. He got very happy, and he made his point, but he made it very aggressively. I don't know if I've digressed too much, but it was that was a tough lesson. at the same time, I actually achieved something and got there with this guy. And in the end, we ended up really close allies together, this producer. So he did me a favour, but it was a tough one. I was really nervous.
When we talked about this before on our podcast, that there's this... often the writer is blamed for what ends up on screen. But there's obviously a process of writer, production, direction. So do you feel like, as a director, you're kind of... You're the diamond edge on the drill in the mine?
By the time I did digress there because you brought us back to the question. By the time we all go in to shoot something, the producer will have been very happy, hopefully with all the collaboration from his script editor and the writer, that the script would be the one they want and they believe in. So I don't think you start blaming the writer for that. Then it's got to be done to the producer and the director. And the director. So yeah, you're responsible for bringing that script to the value it's required. You know that you're all dreaming of.
Did you get a script which, for you personally, you're looking at and you're thinking, this doesn't look or doesn't feel. It doesn't feel as good as you think it could be. Does that make it more exciting to try and bring something out of it, or? Is that a problem if it gets to that point and you're seeing something? Or have you never had that, yeah?
No, I have. I've worked on scripts that in the end were a bit poor. Mm-hmm. But I don't go into the actors and say, this is poor, we'll have to do the best we can with it. But I would always go in knowing I'm going to make the best out of this that I possibly can.
But is that feeling quite an engaging one to actually, you know, to think that?
Oh, I like it as a challenge.
That's what I mean. So you enjoy that sort of...
I do, yeah. And usually, between you and the actors... particularly the actors, because they're the ones fronting and saying the lines. Between you find the way to make it work. And often it just comes off the page anyway. I think we've all worked on things that have been pretty poor against the episode the week before or whatever, the also runs. But in general, you don't gloss them over and try and make them. Well, you do. A lot of people do that. You find the heart of the characters and let the characters, the actors playing the characters, let the characters, the depth of the characters come out. And usually it'll sound right and feel right. And that'll paper, you know, cover the holes, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
so that people will go, oh, pretty poor script, or I didn't like this episode very much. Because the actors are so engaging. So usually you get away with that. I mean, it does happen. You can have scripts there's a mishmash, the producer will agree. This is a mishmash because we never could get the writer to come back and figure out the reasons. So we've got to do the best we can. And hopefully you can cut round it, you know, if it's really appalling in the edit. And you manage, you get through. So that it becomes an all right episode, not so great. But it could be good enough.
Is that sometimes frustrating when you know that, as you say, production is not simply about people being lazy or people not knowing their job? Sometimes it can be just, it's a very difficult process to actually pull something together. Sometimes things go wrong, or sometimes things don't get refined enough. Is it frustrating when do you look at reviews and do you see them, and do you think when you see people sort of say, so you don't look at them?
I don't rely on them.
No.
Because you can, because sometimes they can be really glowing and you can rather chuffed with yourself when actually it wasn't that great or whatever. I do read reviews, and I always want them to be. But if they're poor but informative, I think that's okay. Yeah. If they're just poor, you know, sometimes things are rubbish because they just don't appeal to the person who's watching. Sure. So you have to, if you read five or six reviews, you really have to work out which are the good ones. The good ones, if they're going to criticise, and they hit it on the head, exactly what's wrong, whatever. You can learn from that, but I don't think you can go. You, if you believed every review you read, good or bad, you really wouldn't attempt to do any of it. Because there's always somebody who doesn't like what you do, compared to maybe two or three who do, and that's not you. It still hits you.
I mean, it always frustrates me when I see reviews or people's comments on, you know, Twitter or whatever, and they will sort of say, I don't like this story because it's lazy, people don't know what they're doing, and you're just thinking, it must be very frustrating to be in that production and know that it's never quite as simple as that. It's no one is being lazy. It's just sometimes
it doesn't come off.
It just doesn't. Yeah. And but audiences don't always see, because it's a very enclosed industry. They don't see your how it. I just imagine that'd be quite frustrating. Should we be talking about something Doctor Who-ish? Because we've skirted around Doctor
Who. We do this a lot, don't we? We start. We get guests on. We talk about Doctor Who for like 30 seconds and go off and something.
It doesn't. I don't think it bothers our listeners. Or maybe yeah, maybe it's it because these are stuff they might not. Well,
are you alright for another couple of questions?
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering how the industry has changed from a director's point of view. Obviously, you started 35 years ago?
1982, 83.
And obviously, you worked on Doctor Who in 1983, 4, and then you've done Doctor Who in 2006 and 7, 8, 9,
and 10.
And obviously, you've done lots of other things as well. But what are the differences between how has the industry changed in that time from a director's point of view?
Three things. One is, four things: lack of planning time, lack of rehearsal, proper rehearsal. I don't mean 10 days of rehearsal before you go into a shoot, but 3 days, a read through and 2.5 days of talking through what you're about to shoot on the following Friday, Monday or whatever. Camera script, the way it's laid out, we have scripts that go right across the page, and a camera script to me is all the dialogue is and stage directions are on one. In other words, you split the page.
Yeah.
Maybe 2/3 on the right hand side is this scene description and the dialogue, and on the left there's a lovely margin. The other third is a margin in which a director can write his notes of how he's going to shoot it, or write a camera script. You know, draw the lines of how he's going to cut it together, which is what I do. Right. Even though I'm working single camera, I'll work out all the shots that way. I'm learning my lines of how I'm going to shoot it, what equipment I need, etc. Makeup and wardrobe needed for making notes. She'll be wearing, he will look, he's got a bloody nose, blah. So they can write in the margin. But at the moment, they've got little bits at the top and bits between the lines. The continuity girl has to do tram lines, the lines down which describe each shot. Well, that's all across the dialogue. It's a mess. But if they've got this big margin to the left, I know this sounds really, really anal, but no. It's been done for 100 years. But now we've got script editors who, hundreds of them, who think, oh, this is a screenplay. So we're making a movie and it looks wonderful across the page. It is good for actors. They can learn their lines if they want to be. Everybody needs to write their notes. And if when someone says to me, oh, yeah, but it saves paper by doing it right across. Why? Because I then have to put another sheet of paper on top of every scene or every page to write my shots. It's just daft. So I think we should be going back to page one, which is the way that script is laid up. It worked for David Lean, so I think it's going to work for me. So I'm on a crusade. Before I leave the business, I want it to go back to that. And it will. I'm sure somebody will reinvent the wheel and go, do you know what? Wouldn't it be better if we save paper by having a margin to the left and write all the notes then?
Have you converted any modern day directors into?
Yes, and they all say, "Oh no, I'm not going to bother with that,
really?
Graham." Yeah, and I say, "Okay, well, you'll find that you're going to add bits of paper, which are another bit of paper. You don't need paper; you just write it on the page you've got." But I did a work with one. It's a superb director, and he didn't want to follow that. So I said, "Listen, I've got this is my if I go to do lectures in universities and film schools." I'll get them back on course and they'll soon learn eventually that old git was right. what I really, really find difficult, well, I don't find it, I do it, is to bring actors to a set. You've had a read through, they've had the weekend to think about it. I might have had a conversation on the phone to the artist, different artists, about we haven't really talked about the character. We might have had a little 5-minute conversation on the phone. Excuse me. So on the beginning of each scene, the director and the actors clear the set. Director and actors have the set for themselves. If I wanted it for a half hour, the first would go potty. Half hour, Gav? Can't you knock it together in 5 minutes? Show us in 6 minutes, and then we start setting up. So initial really posh director, you know, you can have everything he wants. If you're a jobbing director, you've got to get the actors in and say, right, you're coming through that door, you're sat there, the third person's doing something else over there, let's play it. They come in, they play the scene naturally, is all you can do. See where they feel naturally they want to land in the set that they've now just begun to understand. And I will look at it and go, well, that doesn't work, why don't we do it? And we just slightly adjust it in order to get the angles that you need for the shots. After the years I've been at it, my attitude now is I think I can shoot virtually anything. We'll find the way. And you can cobble the way around. But actually, over the years, you get experience enough to know what was going to work visually and what's not. And between us, within 5 or 6 minutes, we've nailed a scene. We can make that work. There's no real time to have a good depth of argument about the characterisation of where they've been the scene before. You'd slip those in as they're walking off to get makeup done or whatever. And the crew come in and watch that, and then we start shooting it. And as you're going through it, you then begin to think, oh shit, I've missed a dramatic point here. That, do you know they've just done something 2 scenes before and they should have a memory of that, or they've been hit on the face, shouldn't they be hurting? And you go, oh shit, yes, right, redo that scene or redo that shot again. Hopefully it's the first beginning of the scene. And you manage to get that piece of continuity in line. You know, this is the first day. But once you're on a roll, you begin to start putting it together, and the actors trust you and you trust the crew, and you start to put it together. What a funny way of making a programme or a film. Why don't we rehearse it a bit, properly, 3 days before, and then come into the studio, and the artists just get to know the set, and we just do it. And they know they know where they're going to be. But we don't do that. We waste studio time farting about.
So it's weird, because in a sense, it's obviously, assumedly it's been done for financial reasons, but you would argue that it creates longer time actually when you're actually on set.
Yeah.
That's causing more money.
That's the expensive part. Yeah. It's £20 or £30 of equipment a day being wasted while we're standing around, while we're all waiting for the director and the actors to be ready to show. It's just daft. You don't have to do multi-camera rehearsals. We just need a rehearsal period where we can play a few scenes together. Once you're on a roll and you've got into the feeling of what you're doing, it becomes easier to plot. And actors feel they can say to a director, can I be doing this instead in this scene rather than coming through that day? Can I not be here? And you will either feel, no, you can't do that because you've got good reasons. But you're off, you're into it, and you all trust each other and collaborate. And yet, at the same time, there are wonderful programmes like The Bodyguard. Mm-hmm. It's great to watch. Most exciting piece of television, the first 20 minutes of it, I've ever seen. I thought it was gripping, breathtaking. I was breathless until the first 20 minutes. It's 20 minutes of absolute brilliance. So I don't know how they rehearsed that, because they didn't do what I've just said. I think they did. I think they put it together, got the shape and the intensity. They must have built up until they got it right. But what I'm saying is, it does work. We do have some great productions, but they're all done as I've just described. Mm. And they could be better for the actor and the director if they just had time to talk about it properly off the set the week before. Go home and think about it. That's the biggest thing that I find ridiculous. And yet, there are some great productions, so who's right? I don't know.
It is interesting, because you say, I mean, there's a lot of quality stuff at the moment coming up, BBC, Bodyguard. I mean, the same creative line of duty is an incredible show. How much better would they be if they had a different methodology within the BBC?
How much cheaper? That's probably the biggest thing. They're probably lucky to have achieved, because not all productions achieve that quality. A lot of them suffer because of what I've said.
From what you're saying, I've heard echoed from actors as well, because they are veteran actors who sort of remember the days of the rehearsal, and it sounds like it's far less rewarding.
Well, there were times when, up till about 10 years ago, where actors had the right to come in and say, right, where do you want me or whatever, now they can't say that. They've kind of got to know where they've got to be. They've got to be ahead of the game, have a character already set up. without any discussion really with anybody, a bit in the audition maybe, and then because we would think their audition is the way to play it, it's just daft. I just find the collaboration, you as a director, you've really got to know what you want to get out of the scene with the characters, and if they do it wrong, as soon as they come in, if they're doing it wrong, you've got to know that they're wrong. And it's a collaborative thing. You know, I can't just be on my own working it all out at home and then coming in and saying, right, this is how we're going to do it. They need to be a part of the discussion.
I'm feeling maybe we should swing back to Doctor Who.
If you've got a Doctor Who question.
I'm just wondering, obviously you've done a lot of Doctor Who. What, is there anything, and you've probably been asked this before, maybe it changes, I don't know, but which piece of Doctor Who are you most proud of? Because there's a lot of stunning, gripping things that you've done with it.
Fabulous chance of working with David Tennant. I mean, that's the most pleasing thing of the modern series. Yeah. The real joy came from, for me, starting with Caves of Androzani, yeah, because there was no money, gripping script that couldn't afford to be done, and we made the right decisions by luck, more than judgment, which paid off, which was to stop thinking about putting laser, if people had, all the troops had guns that were lasers, putting all the in the war scenes, battle scenes, putting all those lasers on would have cost and taken so much time in those days, whereas now it's a piece of cake. So we had to make a decision, lose that, hire in submachine guns and blanks, and make it, as I said before, Maggie Thatcher's world, and guns for real, and all hell being let loose with weapons that we all understood and knew, you know, and the sound of it, etc. And doing bullet effects were cheaper than laying on laser beams. That, plus the casting, which was absolutely shit hot by chance. We got the right people to play those parts, and they played them with belief and depth and honesty, these outrageous villains. And what was achieved by, again, Barnes, a new director. It could have gone seriously wrong, and it did. I made decisions that were wrong to do lots of single camera work with multiple big studio cameras, trying to do single camera work on the floor. But I did some, and then I ran out of time, we lost scenes, and I expect that really pissed off the producer greatly. But we still had enough, it had to be cut down anyway, and we still had enough in the end material to make the story work, as luck would have it. And I'm sure we picked up stuff as we went along anyway. I made decisions which were naughty and wrong, and never did them again until I got to single camera, and then it was okay anyway. But the show is still considered today. Something from the 80s was still considered being something rather good. From a little green Herbert like me, and I'm really pleased that I managed to do that. But modern Doctor Who, there are many things, but the one that stands out that I think was smashing to do was Catherine Tate's solo performance in Turn Left. It's not my favourite episode of all time, but Blink is my favourite story of all time. I thought Blink was the best Doctor Who story I've ever seen. But the one for me that I've worked on was 42, which was Doctor Who light, really. He was in the beginning of it and comes in at the end. But she, in that episode, proved to the world what a great actress was on our screens. She's a fantastic actress, and not the comedian. She's a comedian, that's how she's made her fame. But she's set out to be a serious dramatic actor, and in that, I think she proved it. What a wonderful performance she had.
Yeah, absolutely.
She was good. And she is flipping funny as well. I was watching some of your Catherine Tate show week before, which I haven't talked for years, since it was probably first on TV, and it is still absolutely hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, I must admit, I really like 42. I've always thought 42's got a lovely pace to it. I mean, obviously, that's the whole point of it, is the pace, but that really works in that story. And as you,
that was Chris Chibnall, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
It was brilliant.
Yeah, I love that. And a great score as well.
Yes.
Murray Gold scoring that was excellent.
You see, Murray Gold, The music in Kay's arrangement, I hate electronic music. I just, it's just, you know, what's his name? Some of the craft works.
Nicola's going.
Bye bye, Nicola. Craftwork. I'm just not into craftwork. So Doctor Who, the electronic workshop. I went to see Roger Lim, who I knew from a previous story I'd done, not Doctor Who, a play I'd made. He did a jazz school for it, so I trusted Roger Lim. But when I went to see him, I said, when you see this story, it's operatic, it's big, it's Phantom of the Opera. So I don't want just these kind of synth sounds. I want an orchestra. I want it to be Phantom of the Opera. And he, and then he said, what if I use, we've got this big range of a new set of recordings, not recordings, whatever they were, synthesized sounds, which are orchestral sounds. So they're big wind orchestral sounds and big brass orchestral sounds and timpani. What about if I start thinking about using those? Because we haven't used them yet. I said, oh, okay, that sounds good. He said, because it's got to be electronic. It was a style, we've got a statement. But he then created a fabulous score. It was electronic, but it was now orchestral. Yeah. And I thought he really was the third element to the whole story. He was as important as the performances and the cutting of it. And I learnt a great deal from that. Murray Gold. And his use of the music, the themes he created, and now we're using a real orchestra. That, for me, and the emotion that he created for all the different emotions, whether it's funny, dramatic, or emotional, and Doctor Who became really emotional with the leaving of Billy Piper,
yeah, he's doomsday.
It was his score for that episode. Was stunning, extraordinary.
I mean, it's nice in a sense because his scores were so good. They got those CD releases because they became so popular, which was nice because that seemed to encourage people then to look at previous works. And Kate Zandrasani got its CD, didn't it? It got a sound. I'm sure it got released as a single soundtrack.
I'll be honest. I'm
90% sure.
No, I think you're right. Sure it deserved it because Roger. He laughed and I said, I just can't bear electronic music. The thought of having it all over this terrific story we ended up with. But he found the way. It was wonderful.
Well, there are plenty of classic era Doctor Who where the music doesn't match what's
you can often hear the music and you hear stuff which is good, but it's the wrong sort of instruments. It doesn't match. But yeah, Andrazani's got. I mean, you can hear that in your head when you think.
Oh, there's the knelling bell at the as the guys, Doctor guys, Doctor Who's climbing up to get the spectros. Not the anti-spectros, I can't remember what it was now. But there's a knelling bell that's going, John Boyne, the death bell, which is the bell of Doctor Who. Yeah. This chiming away amongst all the orchestra. There's real Phantom of the Opera stuff. It's just brilliant, the way he used that. So he kept it Doctor Who-ish, but he made it also orchestral. It's stunning. Clever man.
Stunning. Got to say, Kay Zandrasani's got that. Fantastic end, part three. Very iconic one.
Yes. With
Davison looking straight down the camera as he's about to crash into the planet. That's sort of mythic now. And the regeneration, I think, is brilliant as well. I think that's a really nice... I mean, I know people sort of make jokes about... I know Peter Davison makes jokes about, you know, Nicola's breasts stealing the scene or something.
I've heard that.
I'm sure it's Peter who said that. Someone said that to me. It's one of the sort of off-libs, might be on one of the commentaries. That,
right. No, probably. That's the sort of thing that happens in commentaries, isn't it?
And it's annoying that, because now someone said that, I just keep looking at it, but in that way. But no, it was brilliant. Brilliant ending. Your agent's telling
you to walk around. I have to go.
Time to go. That's fine. We've been great.
Yes, Graham Harper, thank you very much for joining us.
I have to go. Sorry, boys.
And again, very big thanks to Graham Harper for chatting to James and myself at the VwarpCon event in September 2018. Before we go, this is a Cast Erebus podcast with a K Christmas special, so it's a very happy Christmas and a great new year to each and every one of our listener. Until next time, it's goodbye from us.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.